Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons.
Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Yes, embarrassingly, sitting here.
That's Vanessa over there.
Hello.
I'm Kelly. This might sound very different to you as you're listening to this. It's nobody's fault.
It's nobody's fault.
Oh, it's not?
Well, I mean, if it were somebody's fault.
I know whose fault it is.
It would be yours, Eric.
That's right.
Would you like to explain what's going on right now?
I'm
going to
blame everything going on. Planning making a short film, Crypticon Film Fest going on, taking the wrong car that I usually take. I left all the audio recording gear at home, so we are recording on our phones using a method we've used in the past, so it's at least shown to work. So we're hoping it's going to continue to work.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. So if you hear this, then it worked.
Right. Now, I notice you guys don't have to keep touching your phone to make your screen stay alive, so I hope when I stop touching my phone, it does not turn this off.
No, it'll continue to record.
Okay. You guys, I'm furious.
Shocking information. This is a whole new world. You furious. All right.
So the Super Bowl has passed us now.
Okay, yeah.
The Super Bowl has passed away.
And all of our geeky friends did this thing that I'm starting to just get so fucking tired of. Little tweets or Facebook posts of, oh, is there a game today? Is something happening today? Sports ball? Here's the thing. It's the biggest pop culture event of the year. And you guys are fucking nerds. It's literally an excuse for every company to put out their most interesting commercials. It just has trailers for huge blockbuster geek movies.
Yeah.
It's got a big fucking 15-minute concert in the middle of it. And you guys are nerds, but this is not what infuriates me.
Okay.
All right.
What infuriates me is that if you're writing, is something happening today?
Yeah.
Then you are a hack writer. These jokes are 20 fucking years old. They are not good jokes. You should be embarrassed for having written that.
Oh,
I would love to see good, funny jokes.
Sure.
But I don't want any more of this bullshit. Oh, the Rhiannon concert was interrupted by some sports ball. Yeah, you fucking idiot. We have all heard those jokes for 20 fucking years. Get some better material.
My favorite personal joke is going into, I don't know, Fred Meyer and seeing their big display, which is for pretty much any sporting event whatsoever where they, you know, stack the Mountain Dew or the Doritos in a fun way for the quote-unquote big game.
Sure.
So every time I go in, I'm like, oh, the big game's on this weekend, whatever it is, having no concept of, like, quite what the big game was. But this time, I mean, I did know, so...
That was all right.
Yeah, if you know, I mean, it's obvious the biggest annoyance of that, just beyond it just being done, is that you obviously know what's going on.
Yeah.
So you're not
unplugged.
Anyone.
Look, if Jerry Seinfeld came out and was just like every time, you know, what's with the big game? I'd be as furious.
Yeah.
I just want new material. That's all I expect from you guys.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything else that needs to be said other than you can watch it and enjoy it, or you don't watch it, and that's fine. We don't need to hear about how much you don't like something.
You have been given about a year to work on some new material, so start writing now.
Exactly right. Know that I am judging you.
You've got, what, 355 days or whatever to go until the next one?
Speaking of the big game, I didn't watch it because that's just for nerds.
Damn.
Sports nerd.
I did watch a highlight reel of all the trailers coming out, and that was very exciting. So,
I guess I was a little bummed at the trailers being not different enough from what I've already seen from those trailers.
I don't get, and I'm sure there's some marketing research they're doing that I have no clue about, why they now leak the commercials before the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
It's weird.
So it's like you've want me to get excited to wait for the Super Bowl to see this ad I've already seen, which is probably not really that good anyway.
Well, so. You saw it on your computer, but now you can see it on your 75-inch screen.
That's right. The people doing the fake destroying their TV crap, where it's very obvious, like, whatever team you didn't like, this one was Philadelphia lost, so some Philadelphia fan destroying his TV. And as you watch him destroy, if you look close, in the bottom left-hand corner, the little yellow Best Buy sticker was still on the front, and it was not attached to the wall. So I'm like, yeah, you went, you bought a $150 piece of crap TV at Best Buy so you could get some views. Goody. Yay.
I haven't seen any of those.
Yeah, that's kind of sad, man.
Yeah.
That's
funny.
Wow.
You guys, I saw some movies.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you were doing something during the big game.
That's right. That's right.
You were just on Facebook the whole time.
I saw a little documentary called Plane with Gerard Butler.
How was it?
Look, we all have expectations when a new Gerard Butler movie shows up, right?
Sure. Yeah.
This fills all those expectations.
It is better than its weird-ass title.
It is the laziest fucking title in the world. I'm not sure. You could have called this anything else, but Gerard Butler, I don't know what there is about him. He makes the shittiest movies, and I love every single one of them.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, this one also has Mike Coulter from Evil.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I thought it was quite good.
The trailer looked fun. It's just like you see the poster and the name and go, oh.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I was watching that. I texted my girlfriend. I was like, you're going to want to see this movie.
You didn't wait for her? My God. Oh, man. Okay, well, I'm definitely going to have to move that further up the queue.
Disaster movie.
I know. I almost saw it in the theater so many times and then just didn't. Anyway, that's on me. That's on me. That's a personal flaw I have right now. But I did see in the theater a very recent big blockbuster picture that just came out, which is Ant-Man Quantumania.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
Interesting. What did you think?
Well, you brought it up. You tell me what you thought.
There you go. You go first.
There were a lot of things I enjoyed about it. I kind of liked the space they were in. It was very strange and interesting, the kind of quantum realm. Kang will be a very interesting villain. Moving forward, I'm pretty stoked to see what they do with him. But I mean, I'm caught up from Loki, so I kind of remember where we left off there.
Is MODOK in this one?
Yes.
I'm very confused. I don't know a lot about MODOK. And I was like, I don't know if this is at all true to who he is in any way, shape, or form.
But no, it wasn't. But I got to say, it was probably my favorite parts of the movie.
Oh, okay. MODOK.
Yeah, really interesting how they did his face.
Yeah.
It feels like somebody went into not even After Effects. It feels like they went into Premiere Pro and just pinned a photo into four corners, and it's blatantly meant to look stretched and stupid, but it's pretty fun. I don't know. I enjoyed it. I didn't love it. It felt like every Ant-Man movie to me, and that I feel like it's a little forgettable. Like I'm already starting to, you know, it's starting to slip away through the cracks, but
I liked it. I think we were talking beforehand, Eric, about, you know, being tired of superhero movies. I think I liked it because it was so far away from most of the Marvel movies. It felt more like a Star Wars movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
It did. It had a very, like, the cantina feel. Yeah. There was things that were just rougher around the edges down there. Yeah.
Yeah, the recent ones seem to have fallen too much into, we must set up our next series of whatever we're going to do. And that's really the only purpose for this movie. We're not, this sounds more like it's at least an entertaining film on its own.
Well, it definitely sets up, I guess, what are we in, phase 5 or something now?
Yeah, whatever it is.
But the Kang stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely setting that up, but it feels very standalone.
It does.
And because all of this stuff happened in this, you know, one particular atom, none of it really affected anything that's going on in the movies right now. So I guess I kind of liked it because of that.
Yeah.
Nice. So I had a good time with it. I thought that that Michael Douglas was...
Michael fantastic. Douglas was so funny in this film. It was crazy. He literally... I mean, he had so little to do, but he was never wasted at the same time. It was so nicely weighted. And Michelle Pfeiffer is smoking hot. Holy crap.
Kidding, right?
She looked amazing.
She gets hotter with age somehow.
She was just like, man, that is a foxy lady.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
And Evangeline Lilly, I didn't hate, but I did notice during the credits, it was like turkey unit. And I was like, is this because a certain somebody was anti something and it happened to be a big pandemic and they happened to need to pick up some shots? Maybe. I don't know. I have literally no idea, but I do know that there were some delays.
Yeah,
sure.
But everybody's got a crazy person in their film. Just wait until we see The Flash.
Oh, jeez.
Boy, it sure seemed like a whole lot of people just dismissed him as soon as they saw Michael Keaton's going to be Batman.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. They're going to go. Don't even think that that matters. I mean, just like, oh, ban J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter, except for the game came out and it's going to do wildly well. I mean, really, what do you expect? Like, people be fans, yo. Yeah.
I feel like all these people, whenever they're threatened to be canceled, you know, their downfall is apologizing.
Oh, yeah. Just don't even say anything.
I would just say, fuck you. In fact, from now on, I will just say, fuck you. And then move on. Because once they get nothing out of you, they just move on to somebody else.
Yeah, unless you crop up again saying something ridiculous, right. Just fade into the background.
I mean, Bill Murray, how long did we talk about him? Right. Like, literally, you know, maybe
speaking
a week.
Speaking of Ant-Man.
Exactly, speaking of Ant-Man, because I thought about that when he showed up, and I was like, ooh, how long are we gonna... And he even has this sort of character that's a little bit of a sexually, like... Oh. They mention him in reference to sex, and no big deal. Who cares? Yep. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying that horrible people should get away with stuff. Let me make myself very, very clear. But as far as people who are reacting, it felt extremely short-lived.
And like, horrible people get away with stuff all the time.
Sure. I mean, hey, I've worked in the film industry. I know.
I was going to say, what world do you live in? Oh, yeah, you live in the right world. I know.
I live in the world that sees this very, very up close. And
I saw a weird one. Infinity Pool. Frustrating.
Oh, no. I'm
like, well, it, as a Cronenberg-esque movie, because, you know, he can do whatever he wants to try to separate himself. But just like Stephen King and his kid, there's always an association. And they have similar styles, even though they write different stuff. I feel the same way about Cronenberg. Mm-hmm. Of his three films, I enjoyed this one the least. It's well made. It's interesting. I hated every fucking character in this movie.
Oh, no.
They're all such rich fucks. And their whole point is to just mess with people. That's the whole point of the thing. Is like, we're rich and we can get away with anything. And that is the point of the movie, is that the whole storyline is that. And it's like, man, even the guy you're sort of supposed to involve or like, because he's not the wealthy one, it's his wife that has all the money. Yeah, but you're still being an insufferable prat.
Yeah.
So it's just like, but the filmmaking's good. Yeah. The effects are good. There's a crazy ass drug scene that's really interesting. But it's also kind of uneven. It starts off pretty good, then gets very weird, and the ending's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But it's that kind of, you know, that's the kind of movies he makes. What was his first one called again?
Not Possessor. That was the second
one. Oh, second one. That's actually, sorry, that was the one I was thinking of, which I thought was just phenomenal.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Phenomenal film. This one, a little bit of step back, but it could just be because I didn't like... When you're watching a movie, you kind of want somebody you like, even if you hate like them, you know?
You need somebody to root for on some level. I find that really difficult with films. Like, if I don't like anybody, it's like, why am I sitting here? I feel like I'm being tortured.
Yeah, kind of like Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. I had that same problem with that movie going.
Yeah.
Give me somebody to sort of like, or somebody like Tony Soprano's sister, who was so awful, but she was so good at being awful.
Right.
Like, you loved watching her on screen. So you can have an awful character that's still oddly likable.
Yeah. Well, and even Tony was likable.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
He was the bad guy. He was somehow the... protagonist and antagonist of
his
series. I watched something called Viking Wolf.
Wow, manly name.
Viking Wolf. Okay.
Viking Wolf on Netflix. A Norwegian werewolf movie.
Okay, I heard about, I heard an interview about this on NPR. How was it?
Well, I liked it quite a bit. I wish it had been called something else.
Yeah, that's a very weird, I mean, it sounds like a wolf that decided on a career path.
You know, it does sound that way. But my head then went to, oh, I'm going to see a werewolf set in,
like Viking times.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh.
And it's not. It's no, just it's modern. Just
modern times, yeah. In Norway. They tie it in that the evil of this wolf came across the seas with the Vikings. And I liked it. The werewolf is pretty great looking. When you get a good shot of it, it's definitely a nod to the American Werewolf in London.
Wow. Wow. Nice.
And I love that. I won't give too much away. But it goes to the full wolf, only this wolf looks evil as fuck. And there were some nice twists in it and an ending that I enjoyed a lot. So, yeah, cool. Viking Wolf on Netflix.
Wow.
Thanks.
Incredible.
Do not watch the dubbed version.
Started out that way, did you?
I started out that way, and I was, you know, lying on the couch, and I was like, oh, this is fine. And then I was like, where's my remote? This is not fine.
The sinking feeling of like, it'll be okay. No, it'll be okay. No. No, it's not okay. Well, I went ahead and watched a brand new series that just started. Star Trek Picard Season 3.
Oh, yes.
So, okay. The worst part about Star Trek Picard Season 3 is that it meant I had to finish Star Trek Picard Season 2, which I watched during COVID because I was sick and I was locked in a room and I had nowhere to go. And I still couldn't make it through Season 2 because it was so intolerably awful.
Wow.
So I did go ahead and finish the last 2.5 episodes.
Oh.
That's how close I got and still couldn't do it. Season 3 is awesome. It's a soft reboot. It's basically starts off as Wrath of Khan, where you have two guys who are, you know, out of the field, old Star Trek guys who are kind of getting made fun of by everyone else. Their missions are long past. They're old. They're creaky. They can't move fast. And they're kind of almost in a buddy film together where they need to go on a mission and reroute a ship without them knowing it and try to save another friend. So there's these kind of under elements that feel right in the way that we had talked about with the modern Star Trek remaking Khan and doing so poorly. It felt like this was correct, even if it was repetitive. And, you know, we'll just kind of see where it goes from there. But, cool. Yeah.
When you said that you started watching this, I was going to say, I thought you hated this show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I cannot tell you how many times during those last 2.5 episodes, I was like, oh, okay, the Borg are like that now. Cool, cool. Oh, Guinan, really? That's the way your race be? Awesome. Did not know. Good to understand. Q, okay. Like, the whole time, furious. But, and of course, Picard just being a sweet old grandpa never made sense. But having this sort of reboot where it is new writers, it is a new team. They have, like, the old next-gen font. Is now being incorporated in the title sequence. There's just obviously a lot more love. The set design is so much better. It does suck. My least favorite character from Picard is still in the show, which is Raffi, and I fucking hate her, but it's fine. It's fine.
Take what you can get.
I'll take what I can get. I'm going to take what I can get, you know? Patrick Stewart is a zillion years old, and he is acting in something that is tolerable, so.
Sounds like they got some studio notes and took them.
Yeah, I think Strange New Worlds made everyone go, oh, shoot.
Everybody watch this show.
Everybody watch this show. It's a little more true to Star Trek. And it's a little less Discovery, flash and bang and whiz. Maybe we should follow suit. And yes, they did.
The trailer for it looked pretty good. I'm glad to hear.
Yeah.
Because I stopped in Season 1.
Oh, God.
Is that all right if I just start Season 3?
Yes.
Oh, good. That's what I was going to do either way, nothing. But it's...
It'll be fine because at the end of Season 2, they're basically done. They're like, this character is being left in the past. These other ones are going to go off and do different things. Picard's going to go to his vineyard, which, by the way, is in France, except for in Picard, where it's suddenly in California for literally no reason. It's fine. Okay. Anyway, it's fine.
Oh, my.
It's fine.
It's fine.
Yeah. Speaking of next seasons of excellent shows, Vox Machina returned.
Oh, shoot. Yeah.
And still one of the best D&D recreations ever put on.
And still allowed to go because the lawsuit or the thing got dropped.
It's sort of, it's not quite as profane as Poison Ivy.
Mm-hmm.
Not Poison Ivy, but what's
her name? Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn. But it has, they swear a lot. It's got a lot of violence and
pretend gore I don't stuff. Know what this is.
Vox Machina is based on a YouTube series called Critical Role, which is a bunch of people that for years and years have gotten together and just played D&D. But they're really funny, entertaining people, so it's fun to watch. I haven't watched much of them because every one you pull up is like 3 or 4 hours long.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. But they took all these characters and animated them with what's the Titmouse or Mouse? What is that one Titmouse. Studio?
Yeah.
Excellent animation. I've brought those characters into these and it's like watching a good D&D come to life.
So funny. This is season 2?
Yeah. It's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, on Prime? I guess I should check this out.
It's fun.
Especially since the latest trailer for Dungeons & Dragons looks like...
Yeah, that first one looks...
Well, of course we'll see.
Yeah.
I read this interview and the creators were like, well, we're not going meta at all in this. There's not going to be... Because somebody had said in the interview, you know, I know a lot of people are hoping that we're going to see the actual players like at the end or something like that. And the guy was like, no, we're treating this very seriously. There's humor in it, but it's very serious to the game and the worlds and all of this stuff. And I was like,
yeah, that first one looked like it was just going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Which is more what Vox Machina is. It's just crazy fun.
You know, Chris Pine is not a good actor. I'm not sure why we keep putting him in, especially in things I want to see.
Aww. I enjoy Chris Pine just fine, but he does really play like one kind of role, one zone.
That's okay.
It's sort of like, I think he's kind of like, you know, the Tom Cruise thing. He figured out his niche. If you like it, you're going to like him. If you don't, you're probably never going to.
But we get to have another Hugh Grant being an evil asshole. So I'm excited to see where that goes.
Hugh Grant is in the Dungeons and Dragons.
He is. He looks like he's going to be a bad guy, and he seems like he's going to be quite fun. So
good.
Yeah.
In real life, Hugh Grant is a major asshole, so should be fine.
It's going to be
typecasting.
I've got to just say this, guys. Because we're recording this way over our phones and everything, there's no microphones in front of your faces. Yeah. I can just look at your lovely faces this entire time. This is kind of nice.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very, very easy and smooth, even though I didn't say it easy and smooth.
I feel much worse because I like to hide behind things, and now I can't. So here we are.
Well, who knows? We'll see if this worked at all.
Yeah, that's true.
Why don't we take a little break? And then when we come back, we're going to be talking about Jason Weiss's topic, which was, I still haven't figured out what to call this, movies that are okay but made better by their soundtrack.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. It's me, Talkboy FX Plus. I'm no ordinary pen. Just yesterday, I did a recording. And that's not all. I do sound effects. Hey, let's do lunch. And I even do impressions. Check out my voice changer.
Kiss me, I'm a prince.
Kiss me, I'm a prince.
Talkboy FX Plus recording pen with 6 sound effects and 12 seconds of digital recording from Tiger.
And we have returned. Eric, this is kind of your subject.
Yeah, we brought this one in as sort of for this segment. So I will dive in first. And the idea, like Kelly said before the break, was it's what's a movie that's pretty good or, I mean, pretty okay, but so much more fun because of the soundtrack. And the movie I picked.
Well, hang on a second. Let me put the, 10 minutes the on timer. The timer.
The entry sees how differently the.
It's going to be so much louder.
I'll bet it will be.
We're all of it's going to be.
Can you hear the tick, 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 tick?
Now you guys all know my stress point.
Tick, tick, boom.
Nightmares.
But anyways, I picked 1984's Dune.
Now, the most widely read, talked about, and cherished masterpiece of a generation comes to the screen. Dino De Laurentiis presents Dune.
I see two great houses feuding.
A world where the unexpected...
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown... and the unbelievable meet. Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves. And skies are filled with fire. Where warriors fight with a thought. And kill with a word. A world that holds creation's greatest treasure.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
And greatest terrors. A world where the mighty, the mad,
all I can see is an Atreides that I want to kill,
and the magical,
the sleeper has awakened,
will have their final battle. A world called Dune.
Long live the fighters!
We will kill until no Harkonnen breathes Arrakeen air.
Dune, a world beyond your experience, beyond your imagination.
Dang. Nice.
Yeah, so this was Rotten Tomatoes of 43 from critics, 65 from the audience. Budget of $40
million. Wow.
Which was huge in 1984. Box office of $31
million. Oh. Ooh, so close.
But you can find this all over the place, including a really cool remastered Arrow box set. Ooh. It's really nice. This was directed by David Lynch. At the time, it was directed by Alan Smithy. Mm-hmm. On the new version that was released by Arrow, it is directed by David Lynch. Wow. So he put his name back on it.
Owning it.
You might know him from the Blue Velvet, Elephant Man, Eraserhead, 98 directing credits.
Oh, wow.
Whole shitload of those are the. I looked at it, it's like, oh, this is short. Music video, short. Okay. But, the also written by David Lynch off of Frank Herbert's original book. Lynch basically writes a lot of the shitty shoots. We'll just keep it easy that way. Starring Kyle MacLachlan, who you might know from How I Met Your Father.
Oh, God.
Or 24 episodes of Portlandia. How about 96 episodes of Desperate Housewives?
I remember him in Desperate Housewives.
Or Showgirls. Yes.
I don't remember him from Showgirls. I'm not
sure. That's okay. Yeah. Not really missing anything. This was his first feature, although he was an extra in The Changeling.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Uncredited, but he shows up there someplace. Born and raised in Yakima.
Yeah.
The number two actor listed is Virginia Madsen, who's the narrator. She shows up a lot. Her character in the movie itself really isn't very prevalent, but she's the one at the beginning telling you everything that's going on and shit. You might know her from Sideways or Candyman, Swamp Thing, the TV show, or 125 Other Rows. Francesca Annis, who's in Revolver, Murder Most Foul, The Saint, and we got a bunch of other nice people in this. Patrick Stewart, Linda Hunt, Brad Dourif, Sean Young, and Sting. So, being as this is score kind of based and people Dune. It's Dune, you know. It's like if we were talking about Star Wars, it's like you kind of get the idea. People know a large portion. So I'm really not going to go into too much of the nuts and bolts of the movie. But where the music appears, the first great hit of the music, just the opening credits. This music is big in style. It is written by Toto.
So good.
One of the very early movies to hire a rock band as a rock band to do an actual score. This is not Flashdance or Footloose or something like that where they wrote a bunch of rock songs. This is orchestral music. except for occasionally guitars and stuff get into it. They're best known for Africa, which I'm sure we've all heard at one point in time.
Oh, yeah.
Rosanna, and their huge hit album 4 came out shortly before they were hired, or before they were hired, where they run a bunch of Grammys and did all the things you can possibly do. Also, one of my favorite songs from them, Stranger in Town.
Hmm.
The movie is also enhanced by Brian Eno, which I've got a little bit more about later on. Toto talked a lot about there's such a huge difference between writing a pop rock soundtrack that they did a good job of pulling it off. It is not sound like, oh, we should have had guitars here, but they substituted violins or something. It sounds like orchestral written stuff. But Toto has been used in 66 films and TV shows, their actual songs. But this is the only score they ever wrote. One of the tough things about the movie itself is, I think part of the reason it doesn't work, is the voiceovers with people thinking. Mm. Like there's, after the, I think it's called the Gomjabar, where the guy's talent, Paul's talent, pain is tolerated. The mother walks in and has this great sense of relief on her face. Here, and then there's a voiceover guy saying, "He's my son is still alive." It's like, yeah, I got that from her expression. And there are so many scenes in this film like that. You're like, stop doing that. This would be so much better.
Do you feel like that was added in by the studio?
Some of it does. Some of it feels Lynchian because they're saying weird shit sometimes. Mm. But especially that opening introduction where she explains what the spice is. And
right.
Who the Arconans are and who the... It's like, okay, you're just going to lay the whole movie out. I got it. And Kyle MacLachlan is definitely not book accurate to the 15-year-old, smaller for his age character that Paul is supposed to be. But so what? Patrick Stewart is is great as Gurney. I enjoyed his role in this a lot. He's not in it much, of course, but that's all right. This is a 1984 movie in that the sets are cool as hell. The set building, the physical props and things they made are really cool, but oh boy, the overlay, like the critters that fold space when they're oddly floating through their giant ships, like, oh, that does not look good. The weirding modules are in this film, are not in the book. It is not the things that use the sound that affect things was made up by Lynch because he didn't want to use that because he found the idea of the weirding way in the book unusable because he didn't want to see Kung Fu sand dunes.
Wow.
Because the teachings are a form of fighting. It's not saying words and making things explode. So it's very different from the book. The music is omnipresent. It's in throughout the whole movie, but it's fairly low-key most of the time. There's a few moments where it works really, really, really well. Like when they first arrived to Dune, the score they set up for that is just really, really good. And when they go looking for the spice, I had to do the one thing. They say, I forgot what degree it says, but it's so-and-so degree in the desert right now. 170 degrees Fahrenheit.
Nah.
Oh, that seems hard to walk around in.
But it's dry heat.
Yes, it is. That's right. It's very dry. The music helps a lot in the weird dramatic scenes, especially the idea of the worms, these giant worm things coming up out of the sand is kind of silly and strange looking. But then you've got this awesome music enhancing what you're seeing. So it feels epic, like, wow. And that's part of what really helps this movie. And the great battle music at the end when they, like the strongest thing in Dune is desert power. Gurney, set off the atomics! I'm like, what? But that's all right. And I, like I said it before, I really like MacLachlan in this. I love his speeches when he's talking to the Fremen at the top of the thing and talking about how they're coming, how their emperor would come for you. I think he's just got great, powerful delivery. What you gonna do? A whole lot of weirdness around the rest of the movie. Although, honestly, I really like this film.
Yeah, I do too.
I enjoy it a lot. There's some way over the top stuff with the Harkonnens, mm-hmm. where the one guy is just so gross.
Yeah.
And Sting is so oddly turned on by all the horrible violence that happens. That scene when he walks out of the steam, you know, the one that made him a superstar, was supposed to be nude mm-hmm. originally. And he was going to do it. But the studio said, no. We're giving you $40 million. You're going to cover that man when he goes out of his theme.
That's a bad idea. I mean, Sting, the biggest band in the world at the time, and he's going to be nude in your movie, which may or may not have people come to it, but would definitely come to it to see Naked Sting.
For sure.
Exactly, yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he was real overhyped almost in this movie. He's really good, but he's in like three scenes.
Yeah.
So, but that's okay. Indirectly, Queen doing the Flash Gordon soundtrack led to Toto doing this soundtrack because they're both Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh.
And he liked, obviously, what Queen did was better for Flash Gordon than what the writers and directors did for Flash Gordon. Toto turned down Footloose to do Dune, because they were sold on the idea this is going to be the new Star Wars. Mm. They're like, oh, well.
It's probably a good call. I can't imagine Toto doing Footloose.
That's a couple other little really cool things. Brian Eno. I'm going to get that to that. He's credited very strongly as a music guy. He wrote one theme.
Oh.
It's used a lot. The theme when Paul takes the water of life is that theme that he wrote. Mm-hmm. And it's used several times called the prophecy. Mm-hmm. So usually when they're talking about Paul and the prophecy, they're using his theme. But that's the only thing he wrote. The Toto guys got really annoyed with it, going, I could write stuff like that. Then he tried to. He's like, this shit's hard to write. That covers most of the good shit. Most of there's a few other things, but a lot of it's well-known stuff, like it killed McLaughlin's career for a few years, and David Lynch hates the film.
Yeah.
But for the first time ever in 2022, he hinted at the possibility of him doing a director's cut of it.
Oh.
But up until then, he basically never talked about it.
Remember, he was offered Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, exactly.
And took Dune instead because he wanted something that was going to be more his style. And then, of course, the studio took it away from him and tried to make it as commercial as possible.
Yep. Mm-hmm. If you want a really fun Dune thing and you haven't seen it already, watch the Jodorowsky documentary about what he was going to do with Dune, which would have been a 12-hour movie if he had done it. With who all was on it? With
Mick Jagger, I know.
Mobius, the artist, was going to be designing with H.R. Giger and Dan O'Bannon and Salvador Dali and Pink Floyd doing the soundtrack.
Yeah.
This would have been a trippy film. But
you know what? I wish I had thought to do Flash as my movie, Flash Gordon. That's a great choice. Vanessa, are you ready?
I think so. I hope so.
10 minutes on the time.
All right. So I whiffed this assignment a little bit in that I really should have gone with specifically like a movie whose score was uplifted by the choice. And instead I went with a movie whose actual sold CD soundtrack uplifted the marketing of it. So I went a little bit of a different direction, but my film was 1998's Godzilla.
All units, this is 7 November, call.
Target's heading right at us.
He's too fast.
Panamanian government, evidence of passengers dead or alive. Please stand by.
It's only 200 miles off the eastern American seaboard. We don't even know what the hell it is.
Thank you.
pissed.
You can tell because I've got the commemorative Taco Time cup.
Yeah, I'll have to get a photo of that, post that on the page.
It's definitely
awesome and insane and impossible to use. So I have not seen this movie in a very, very long time. It's pretty long. It's 2 hours, 19 minutes. Really low ratings, 19% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 28% from audience. The budget is between 130 and 150 million.
Holy shit.
I know. Wow. I know. And the box office... 379 million.
Right.
It did good. Geez. Yeah, it did real good. For as much shit as it got, it did really, really well. Directed, of course, by the most amazing director of all time, Roland Emmerich. Speaking of disaster films, he has 22 directing credits and 30 producing. He's well known for Independence Day, Day After Tomorrow, Stargate, Universal Soldier, and written by both Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin, who was his partner for a while. They worked together on the scripts for Universal Soldier, Stargate, Independence Day, and then split apart. Devlin went on to do things like Geostorm and the Ark TV show. He produced Eight-Legged Freaks and the Leverage TV series. And of course, Roland Emmerich's films since have not necessarily had the strongest scripts. So we may or may not be able to contribute those. Not totally sure. The music for this, it's mostly composed by David Arnold. So he does the score, and it feels like a very typical action score. It is actually a pretty decent, decent score. It's same guy who did Independence Day, Casino Royale, The World Is Not Enough, The Patriot. It works. I think it works well. However, the soundtrack has the famous Puff Daddy come at me. Come.
Which is, sampled from Kashmir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good. I remember watching it nonstop playing over and over, Come With Me, over and over again on MTV and loving it. And thinking this movie must be the best movie of all time. Because it's just him in a skyscraper, like, rapping at Godzilla and like basically like, you know, kind of trying to hit at let's rumble, let's have a fight. It's so good. Also has on the soundtrack the Wallflowers playing David Bowie's Heroes. It has Jamiroquai, Foo Fighters, Ben Folds 5, Rage Against the Machine. Just a pretty strong, it was a marketing thing, right? Sure. It was very much like, this is going to be cool along with my Taco Time cup. Starring Matthew Broderick as Dr. Nick Totopoulos, 81 films, including Ferris Bueller, War Games, which we've talked about, Election, and Lion King as Simba. Jean Reno, who plays Philippe Roach, who's a French sort of CIA agent. We know him from Ronin, Leon the Professional, and of course, the Pink Panther. And a few other people that you may have heard of, including Hank Azaria. 104 credits, including, I don't know, Birdcage, Mystery Men, and 736 episodes of The Simpsons. Jesus. That's okay, because we also have Harry Shearer in this. 177 credits, including Mighty Wind, Spinal Tap, and 747 episodes of The Simpsons. So, and then a face I recognized, Doug Savant, who I know from 175 episodes of Desperate Housewives. So... speaking of, it's a strong Desperate Housewives theme tonight. The story it starts off as a super typical Roland Emmerich joint. We have this big ship out at sea. We've got a guy eating some noodles, watching sumo wrestling on the TV during a huge storm. They're obviously doing some kind of canning and fishing operation on the ship, which I didn't know you would do canning on a ship. I thought you just do fishing, but whatever. What do I know? It's somewhere off of the coast of Japan. Suddenly, the radar shows a huge object coming straight at them. Claws rip through the ship. People fall off of, their bunkers and knives, like, fall over the place. People are running around, very, normal people doing normal things, trying to cope with the crazy situation. Very Roland Emmerich. A tail whips through and breaks through the observation glass. Cut to Dr. Nick Totopoulos is in Chernobyl. Dr. Nick, I know. I was like, it might be on purpose. There's a lot of weird Simpsons jokes embedded within this. He's in Chernobyl studying large earthworms that were affected from nuclear radiation. However, of course, a huge helicopter comes in, grabs his worms, grabs his truck, and says, "You're coming with us. We got something you gotta see, Dr. Nick." And he, of course, arrives, is really flustered and frustrated. He doesn't know why he's there. He's not done with his worm work. He's the worm guy. And finds himself standing in something that the guy's like, "Well, how about you study this?" He's standing in the middle of a giant footprint, three-toed, massive thing. And apparently there is something else that's been affected by radiation that they want him to take a look at. He starts to work with the military and a weirdly sexist boss who's like super harassy immediately. I'm like, man, this is some weird reverse sexual, I don't know. Meanwhile, in New York City, Nick's ex-girlfriend is an up-and-coming journalist working under Harry Shearer. She wants a promotion. She wants to really start becoming a real journalist and maybe even get on TV, but he says it'll only happen if she goes on a date with him. Don't mind the fact that he's married. Her friends are like, "You're way too nice for the city. You're never going to get anywhere." So at this point, Godzilla leaves Asia, heads straight for New York City. Nick and the military make their way there. Godzilla walks straight past Audrey, hanging out at the cafe with her friends, enjoying some drinks, and everybody starts to crash into each other. And it becomes a very typical Godzilla film where they're after him. He's kind of hiding around buildings, not necessarily on purpose. It's just he's big and they're big. And then he starts tunneling underground, which is kind of awesome. The big twist in this film, of course, is that Godzilla lays eggs. He lays eggs, and that's cool. Yo, love it. Great twist. Nick was working with the government. Things fall apart. He ends up having to work with the French special operative CIA. They work on trying to get rid of the nest while the military specializes only on killing Godzilla. They don't think the nest matters, even though there's like 200 eggs in Madison Square Garden, and they are all really just mini Tyrannosaurus Rexes that are going to murder everybody. This film, the things I like about it, there's a cool mix of practical and CGI. The Godzilla in the actual film looked like shit. They didn't have the right film stock when they put the CGI onto the film and sent it to cinemas, and it looked like literal garbage. So since the Blu-ray release, they have put it back out the way they intended for it to look. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you heard people say it looked awful, that is a big part of why. They have a lot of little miniature work with the trucks and the cars. Everything feels very lived in. The city feels like a city. I mean, you don't have that weird kind of empty space thing you get now with modern city films. Despite looking wicked angry, Godzilla, actually, they did a good job of making him relatable and sympathetic through the eyes of Nick, which was actually a pretty tough job. The babies coming out of their shells were extremely stressful as fuck. They are, unfortunately, definitely ripping off a lot of Jurassic Park. This film is fucking all over Jurassic Park. They're a little too self-referential. I hated Matthew Broderick and his female love interest for the first two-thirds of this film. They are an awful match. And there's a weird obsession with Roger Ebert through this entire thing. Siskel and Ebert, I should say, they name the mayor Ebert and then continue to basically torture him. And he looks just like him. There's a lot of thumbs up, thumbs down humor.
Wow.
A little bit of trivia. I don't know how far I'm going to make it through this, but from taglines include "Size Does Matter" from the creators of Independence Day and "The City That Never Sleeps Just Got a Wake Up Call."
Oh, boy. Oh, nice. Okay.
Toho Studios gave TriStar Crew a 75-page dossier with what they could and could not do with Godzilla's character. This included Godzilla's origins had to be tied to a nuclear accident. He cannot eat people, only fish. He has three rows of dorsal plates.
I wonder how they pulled off the eggs then, because has Godzilla laid eggs in other movies?
Well, there's been a baby Godzilla.
Yeah.
So many of these points were disregarded. As creature designer Patrick Tautopoulos never received the list of rules, I know, despite Roland Emmerich having forwarded to him. Thus, the only specific instructions he followed was that Godzilla should only be able to run incredibly fast and that he shouldn't resemble a dinosaur too closely. Many later yeah, incarnations of Godzilla, overseen by Toho themselves, would also gradually dismiss these rules and create new ones for various movies. So if you're like, that's weird, these rules, that's because Toho stopped giving an F. The lead role was specifically written for Matthew Broderick.
Wow.
I know. He didn't even read the full script when he took it.
He's like, you're offering me what? Oh, sure.
When Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel saw the film, they, of course, both gave it a thumbs down. They they said that the filmmaker spoofing them was petty and said, if you're going to go through the trouble of putting us in a monster movie, why don't you at least take advantage of the monster either eating us or squashing us? They later named it as one of the worst films of 1998. Shocking.
Well, come on. I'm not gonna just go with blaming Siskel and Ebert not being made fun of in it for that listing.
There is one piece of trivia that I think is pretty important. Roland Emmerich admitted he did not like the original Godzilla, only agreed to the project after being promised to be able to do whatever he wanted with the series. This was in contrast to the film's original director, Jean DeBont, who did Speed, was going to do it. He grew up a fan of the character, and looking back on the film, TriStar producer Robert N. Fry described how the team that took over Godzilla was one of the worst cases of executive incompetence I have observed in my 20-year career. One of the golden assets of our time was managed as poorly and ineptly as anybody can manage an asset. Emmerich himself has since expressed regret in taking the job. So he didn't really give a shit about Godzilla. Made a Godzilla movie. Spielberg apparently told him, hey, don't make this movie. And he did anyway.
Sort of like, I get where you're loving it. That's like me with the Dune. It's objectively got some bad shit in it, but I love it. I don't care.
Yeah. It has so much Emmerich stuff in it that I really enjoy. Like, it steps on a cab, and then the next shot, you see the wheel bouncing away. Like, there's just these fun touches that are so Emmerich that I enjoy. But it is, the cast, Hank Azaria and Harry Shearer and Jean Reno are incredible.
Yeah.
They do such a fucking good job. They carry that film. Matthew Broderick, I think near the end, really picks up steam, but he is baggage for a long ass time. You want to punch him in the throat. So, I don't know.
Saw this opening night.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I believe that.
Didn't love it, but I didn't understand where all the hate was coming from. It's not a horrible movie. It's just not a good Godzilla movie.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I think it was just one of those summer, we can all agree to shit on this film movies.
Plus, Roland was in that realm of being hated by critics by that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were ready to eviscerate him for something.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Well, and also, you know, the original Godzilla movie was metaphor for a nation that had undergone the horrors of atomic bomb. But if you dig deeper, the movie is really about a gigantic lizard stomping.
Yeah. It's hard to know what direction to take when you've got that presented in front of you. Big lizard stomp or nuclear holocaust?
I would go with where the sequels went with those two ideas. I think you could see where Godzilla are.
Godzilla versus Kong. That's where it should go. That's where it should always go.
All right. My turn.
Yes.
Pick the movie that's actually pretty good, but that I have some real problems with that I love because of the soundtrack.
Oh,
there you go.
Perfect.
The movie I picked is from 1981. It is Michael Mann's Beef.
Are you clear?
You've been putting down 2-3 scores a month.
You want to put down contract scores all over the country, working directly for me?
I am self-employed. Geisty lice. Just diamonds or cash.
Fine. I'll make you a millionaire in 4 months.
I wear $150 slacks. I wear silk shirts. I wear $800 suits. I wear a gold watch. I wear a perfect D, flawless, 3-carat ring. I'm a thief.
Do you think that I have been waiting for you to come along?
You're going to marry her and have some kids?
Yes.
Hey, I'm talking to you. Hey.
Hey, what? What is going on in your life that is so terrific? I'm just asking you to be with me. Go.
I got a problem.
I want my money.
We need new partners. We're in for 10 points.
I am the last guy you want to mess with. You get paid what I say. You do what I say.
You don't know from one day to the next whether you're going to be killed, go home, or get busted.
What's wrong with you?
James Caan, Thief.
Have you seen this movie?
No. Not in a very long time, but it's cool.
Yeah. Budget of $5.5 million, box office of $11.5 million. Rotten Tomatoes critics score is 79%, and the audience has it at 81%. I think that's kind of generous. Written and directed by Michael Mann. He did Manhunter, Heat, Collateral, created Miami Vice. He did To Live and Die in L.A., which is one of the movies I absolutely love of his.
Yeah.
He also did a really bad adaptation of F. Paul Wilson's The Keep.
Oh, I always forget that was his.
Mm-hmm. This is also based on Frank Holmer's novel, The Home Invaders. It stars James Caan, 138 credits, including The Godfather, Freebie and the Bean, Rollerball, Alien Nation, and Misery. Tuesday Weld, who has 64 credits, including Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Once Upon a Time in America, and Heartbreak Hotel, which is a lovely movie about a kid who kidnaps Elvis for his mom. You gotta watch this movie. It's so good. It also stars Willie Nelson. 76 credits, including Honeysuckle Rose, Wag the Dog. He was, of course, Uncle Jesse in the Dukes of Hazzard movie.
Sure.
And Jim Belushi, 157 credits, including Trading Places, Red Heat, The Last Action Hero, and Return to Me, one of my very favorite romantic comedies. So, Thief, we open on Frank, who's a safecracker, performing a heist from a particular building, and he gets a bunch of diamonds from them, and he escapes, and we meet his accomplices, which include Barry, who's James Belushi, and his fence, Joey Gags. But before he can collect his share, which is about $185,000, keep in mind this is 1981, that's about $3 million. $185,000, Gags is thrown out of a 12-story window for skimming money from the mob. So Frank goes and threatens the guy who killed Joey Gags, and he ends up getting his money and an offer to work with the mob in a capacity that makes his job a lot easier. So they'll set up all of his heists, but they do all the research for him and all the setup. And if he gets caught, they have a lawyer for him and all of that. And at first he's like, fuck off. I'm a loner, daddy. And but then they contact him about a huge job that will allow him to retire and get out of the business for good. This is his thoughts, not their thoughts. I almost used this movie for the One Last Job episode. We're introduced then to the rest of Frank's life. He's got a used car dealership and a bar that he owns and he uses to launder money through. But he has no family, and his closest friend is Willie Nelson, whose name is Okla, who's still in prison and was a mentor to Frank. And by the way, Willie is dying of cancer. And although he only has 9 months left in the joint, the doctors don't think he's actually going to live that long. It almost feels like they're setting up a Frank's going to break Okla out of prison, which is, you almost want that story more than what you get. But Frank has also hit it off with a pretty cashier at his bar. And he has this very emotional night with her where he breaks down and kind of tells her everything about himself. So with all that going on, and then this job offer comes in, he thinks that this one last job net him nearly $1 million back in 1981. And that's all he needs to quit, get Okla better health care, and move to this tropical island that he keeps like a postcard that he's created in his pocket. So he accepts this big job that the mob sets up for him. And it's a very kind of convoluted heist where he has to do all this really cool safe cracking stuff to get into. And it's worth watching this movie. Well, I'll get to that. The safe cracking stuff is the reason you watch this movie. There's this B plot of a couple of dirty cops who are also wanting to shake him down and complicating his life. And a C-plot that's thrown in where he and his new girlfriend are able to adopt a baby from the black market.
What?
Which is all part of his plan of retiring and becoming a normal guy, but it all starts to fall apart pretty quickly. First, Okla dies, although Frank has been able to get him out to see regular doctors. The cancer is too far along, and that really shakes his world. He's kind of lost. He doesn't know exactly what to do. When he goes to collect his money from the mob after doing that heist that was so good, it was supposed to be nearly $1 million, they give him about $100,000 in cash. And he's like, feels a little light. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, yeah, we've taken the liberty of investing the rest of this money in a shopping mall for you.
Oh, my God.
And he's like, yeah, fuck you. You'll have the rest of my money tonight or there's going to be problems. And the mob basically tells him, well, you're a dead man. So the movie has this great final act, kind of. It's an amazing set piece where he's going through and systematically offing the guys who are trying to kill him. And it's a pretty cool scene. But then the movie ends in this way that just infuriates me. No resolution to his personal problems and leaves me very unsatisfied. I think the movie is kind of a mess, but it is held together by those safe-cracking set pieces because he had to do all these really cool things like these, light these huge metal rods and get them so hot that he could burn through the safe and everything. And these are actual safe-cracking methods that were being used by the real safe-crackers at the time. And those scenes are then set against the music of Tangerine Dream.
There you go.
And they're so fantastic. You don't really care that the rest of the movie is only so-so. So, trivia on this. The music is by Tangerine Dream. They are a German electronica band. They have over 86 releases, including studio EP or mini albums, and 50 of them are soundtracks, including Sorcerer, The Keep, the original Firestarter. The only reason to watch that movie is to have that soundtrack. Legend, 3 o'clock High, Near Dark, Miracle Mile. This particular soundtrack is out of print for some reason. I have a lovely vinyl copy, of course.
Of course.
The screenplay for this film was adapted from the novel The Home Invaders, written by Frank Homer, who is a professional thief. Oh. Homer was serving time in prison while this movie was being made.
Oh, my God.
While James Caan liked the movie, he found the part challenging to play, saying, I like to be emotionally available, but this guy is available to nothing. Wow, my trivia just repeated over and over, so I feel like I didn't get the right stuff on here. This is the film debut of Jim Belushi, William Peterson, and Dennis Farina.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And then let me see if I can remember some of the trivia, because it did not come on here. There's a lot of stuff going on here where the people who were... what we call them, consultants, were actual criminals.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
The security for the film were off-duty cops, and a lot of them were family members with the criminals.
Oh.
Holy shit.
So it was like that crazy movie thing that makes no sense. You know, you went one way and I went another. So they would just all get together and chat and everything. And because a lot of the guys had served their time, they would tell the cops how they had done a lot of the stuff. Because they were working with guys who had actually caught them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So holy crap.
Crazy, crazy set. I wish that I had got more or looked closer at my stuff. I just over and over pasted the same trivia. Anyway, the soundtrack is really spectacular. I love writing to it.
Oh, Michael Mann, he's just, I mean, that's kind of what he's known for.
Yeah.
That's what made Miami Vice work.
Yeah, he ends up using Tangerine Dream on The Keep also, and that's really the only reason to watch this movie.
Yeah, isn't that great? I love the one they did for Legend.
Yeah.
Legend's a phenomenal score.
Yeah.
They're really good.
Very cool. Well, cool idea, Jason. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My mom is trying to call right now as I'm recording.
I wonder if that interfered with the recording.
Well, let's hope not. Okay, so who's got the next pick?
Well, yeah, I do.
Oh, right. Okay.
So going with a idea of a movie that's just got a good hand-to-hand combat scene, whether it takes up the whole movie like Enter the Dragon, or if it's just a cool scene like in They Live. Ridiculous, cool scene.
I love it. Okay.
Nice.
Well, okay, so then this is the part where we thank everybody for liking the Shang Post, for participating in the Value for Value model, for sending us nice little notes. I have had a really interesting discussion with Michael DeBronzo over this particular film. Oh, shit.
Time's up.
I see your trivia lacking, I guess.
Boy, that scared the fuck out of me. I'm sorry, Vanessa. Is this what you go through every time?
Every time. Every time. Remember this.
Michael DeBronzo and I have been talking about a particular film that I'm going to make you guys watch and make us all talk about at some point here shortly.
Ooh.
Probably when it's my next choice. So, and stuff like that I think is really neat. You know, it's that's the whole point of the value for value.
Yep, so, exactly.
Also, if you want to leave us a message on the Strange Eons Radio hotline, that number is 253-237-4266. Anything else, guys?
I don't think so.
No. Just keep liking, sharing, commenting on our weird shit, and let us know what you think. We haven't had a lot of people do it, but yeah, we really would like to see or hear what movies you think fit into the category that we didn't talk about.
Right. Yeah.
We get more of that. We get some of that on YouTube. We get some pretty weird stuff from Bad John. I don't know if you go and read his comments, but he's got some interesting stuff.
I need to get on there and look at all those. Well, all right, guys. I really hope this turned out. If it didn't, you'll be getting an episode of Amityville, too.
Yeah, and you'll never know about this.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right, we'll be back in 7 short days, and we are talking Fistmates.
Transportation and other considerations for Strange Eons Radio produced by Pan Am Airlines. When you think of traveling, think of Pan Am. You can't beat the experience. Guests of Strange Eons Radio stay at Econo Lodge Everett. It's an easy stop on the road, you know what I mean. Strange Eons Radio is recorded live in front of a studio audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Sit, Ubu, sit.
Yeah, that's a very weird... I mean, it sounds like a wolf that decided on a career path.